Today, April 7th, 2018, I welcome you in Bible study again. Last time we peered into Isaiah chapters 30 through 36, going here a little and there a little, and spoke of Egypt. I showed that by figurative speech, it symbolizes a world dominating theology. We saw that her pyramidic mountain, though high, is dark and false. We saw that the Son of David, who is the Lord's opposing light, must prevail to become her single eye capstone, the light of the world. But herein lies a mystery. In those same texts, both Egypt and Assyria seem to be interchangeable icons. Perhaps you've noticed that. And this leaves us perplexed. Hence, our fourth study of series 39 will unravel our confusion. It is entitled Assyrian-Egyptian Paradoxy. A paradox is a tenet that is contrary to received opinion. Contradictory and conflicting conclusions and concepts, as Webster. Those historic titles, Egypt and Assyria, are given as coded speech. We learned of them from Bible history, and then wisdom applies their labels to current powers. God delights in hidden codes. In fact, he tells us in Matthew chapter 11, verse 25 and 26, I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent, and hast revealed them unto babes. Even so, Father, for it seemed good in thy sight. It's amazing Christ gives Father credit. May not have seemed good in his sight, but he recognizes Father as being all wise. So, God delights in hidden code. He does so to protect us from Satan and others. People that are self-exalting evil men desires to use knowledge to exploit our trust in God so as to exalt themselves to power, to his throne. They choose this tactic rather than the Lord's testimony of Jesus' recommended tactic of seeking meekness. Consider some historic examples. Remember, it was Caiaphas in John chapter 11, verses 41 through 50, where he reasoned together with the leaders of the Jewish community. Let it be not mistaken, Caiaphas was the theological leader of Judaism. Quote, then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council and said, what do we? For this man doeth many miracles. If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation. Interrupting the quote, I put special emphasis. Their concern was they didn't want to lose their place. The quote continues, and one of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, ye know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, that the whole nation perish not, close quote. See, I refer to this as the Caiaphasian Jew. And their response was that Jesus had to die so that their place could be preserved. Because if he continued forward committing the miracles, the world would be convicted and they would lose their place. See, there's this desire to be in the stead of God. Unfortunately, they step on people. Think of the popes. Think of all the people whom they've killed for theological disagreements. Think of the money that they have extracted from the populace through error, teaching people they had to pray their relatives out of purgatory. Think of the Seventh-day Adventists and the Davidian Seventh-day Adventist leaders. They're perhaps worse than all of them because they know of the slaughter of Ezekiel 9. And rather than tell their flock, even their families, you have a right to have a personal relationship with the Lord. You go do what you think is right. I love you. I don't want to see you fall by the sword. But instead of doing that, they use their knowledge to leverage on the people their influence, their women, their children and whatnot, their friends and their relatives, by getting them to fall with them in the slaughter and sealing them from the light of the Lord. I tell you, the Father did well to hide his theology, because when he unfurls it, as we shall see, it brings embarrassment to those who have postulated of false doctrines. Because the evil men who seek to exalt themselves, we've seen examples throughout history, to force people into monetary exactitude, sexual exploitation, slavery. All these things follow as gratuitous benefits of their reign. As we advance in our study, and as we more closely and carefully examine the meaning of Egypt, let us turn to Isaiah chapter 30, reading verses 1 through 4. And I just want to cement home the point that Egypt represents a theology. Verse 1 of Isaiah 30. Woe to the rebellious children, saith the Lord, that take counsel. They do what? They take counsel. Somebody's whispering in their ear, telling them what's right and what's wrong. But not of me. And that cover with a covering, but not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin. Please note that these are rebellious children. A woe is pronounced against them. For them to be rebellious is indicative of the fact that they knew better, but that they resisted the promptings of the Lord. Hence, they took counsel, but the counsel was not endorsed by the Spirit of the Lord. Not endorsed by the Spirit of prophecy. Even though they quote the rod, and even though they quote E.G. White, they do so illegally and against the Spirit's well-established protocol for understanding their doctrine. They were told to never elevate it above the Scriptures. But yet, and still, they take counsel that completely ignores the Scripture, resulting in them adding sin to sin. They've already been condemned, as we found out 2 weeks ago. They've already have been immersed in sin, but something changes now. Time has moved forward so that they've become emboldened and said, let's increase our sin. Indicating that the journey to Egypt was not a theological excursion that they had practiced in the past. It's a second edition of sin. He says that take counsel, and they cover themselves with counsel, but not of his spirit. Let me just refer you to the work of the Spirit and its commission. John chapter 15, verse 26. But when the Comforters come, whom I will send unto you from the Father, even the Spirit of truth, which proceedeth from the Father, he shall testify of me. And ye also shall bear witness, because ye have been with me from the beginning. Therefore, the Lord's grievance in Isaiah chapter 30 is that they take counsel and they take covering. In other words, they feel shielded and protected by a covering that is not endorsed by the Spirit. They're at war with Christ. They're at war with the one whom he sends from the Father, the Spirit of truth. I tell you, therefore, that the counsel of Egypt is indicative of doctrines that are perpetuated clandestinely with a cover that has taken place amongst the rebellious children. The rebellious children are representative of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Ezekiel chapter 3 makes mention of them when he tells Ezekiel to take the gospel to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Chapter 2, verse 7 and 8, quote, "And he said unto me, Son of man, stand upon thy feet, and I will speak unto thee. And thou shalt speak my words unto them, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear, for they are most rebellious." Ezekiel's called the Son of Man. The quote continues, "But thou, Son of Man, hear what I say unto thee. Be not thou rebellious like that rebellious house. Open thy mouth and eat that I give thee." Close quote. Be ye not rebellious like that rebellious house. That'll help us to pinpoint and isolate the application of Isaiah chapter 30. Isaiah 30 continues. Verse 2, that walk to go down into Egypt, and have not asked at my mouth, to strengthen themselves in the strength of Pharaoh, and to trust in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore shall the strength of Pharaoh be your shame, and the trust in the shadow of Egypt your confusion. For his princes were at Zoan, and his ambassadors came to Hanes. It tells you that it's a journey to Egypt, which means that it's a place where the Christian church did not openly abide in beforehand. In fact, they are zealous to secure the strength of Pharaoh. Pharaoh's strength is in her connections with the occult. It's in her secret society codes of ethics that enforce by penalty of death those that violate her secrets. It's the essence of Masonry. So zealous are they to garner this strength, because people who are desirous of power never want to be unseated. They don't care what they learn. They certainly don't care what you learn. If it contradicts what they teach, then it's an effacement of their valor and their stature. They're not seeking after meekness. They're like Satan seeking after self-exaltation. The woe is pronounced again. Woe to them that go down to Egypt for help, and stay on horses, and trust in chariots, because they are many, and in horsemen, because they are very strong. But they look not unto the Holy One of Israel, neither seek the Lord. They've accelerated their pace. They've trusted into a faster method that's less arduous for them to journey to Egypt. They've taken use of horses that will allow them to go back to Egypt. They have confidence because it says that the theology of Egypt is so prevalent. It says they want to go down to Egypt because they are very strong. This is what the Masons will tell you. Everybody on the police force, everybody in the fire department, everybody in politics belong to Masonry. They have to be a Mason. Therefore, we can sadly see the fact that the church is taking a spiritual journey. But if we have obtained a picture of the journey, because we've seen in Isaiah chapter 31 that they're riding in horses and in chariots. Well, when you ride in horses and chariots, or as it expresses in chapter 30, when you walk, you're traveling over space and time. That poses a very interesting question. Where is the church's origin? Seems to be a fair question, right? If she has to travel to Egypt, then her origin is not in Egypt. She's in a different land. The land that she's in is the land of Assyria. So that's the distinction between Egypt and Assyria. Assyria is the land of the Seventh-day Adventist Church's abidance. Let us talk more about that as we advance, because that brings really the resolution to our paradox. Let me show you some evidence that Assyria was intended to be distinguished from Egypt on this basis, Egypt represents the theology, Assyria represents the territory. Isaiah chapter 8, verse 6 gives us a window. In fact, we should read from verse 6 through verse 8. For as much as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloh, that go softly, and rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son, now therefore behold, the Lord bringeth upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria, and all his glory, and he shall come up over all his channels. That's a point of very key focus. Did you drink it in? And he shall come up over all his channels, and go over all his banks, and he shall pass through Judah. He shall overflow and go over. He shall reach even to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel. So Emmanuel represents God with us. He's in the land of Assyria. If he weren't in the land of Assyria, then by her overflowing her banks would not be a problem for the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It would not result in inundation. In fact, he swoops down and overflows even Judah. Judah represents Davidia. So much so that he comes up to the neck. What's above the neck is the head. He doesn't overflow the mustard seed, the head, the Lord's ordained leader amongst Davidia, amongst Judah. We need to understand that water is a universal Bible symbol for doctrines. I told you we're dealing with coded speech. But John chapter 4, not losing our place in Isaiah chapter 8, John chapter 4 helps us in this resolve. Let's read verse 11. The woman said unto him, Sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From whence then hast thou that living water? Art thou greater than our father Jacob, which gave us the well, and drank thereof himself, and his children, and his cattle? And Jesus answered and said unto her, Whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again. But whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. Without much cross-referencing, we know that the testimony of Jesus is the source of our life. John 12, how many times have we been over that scripture where the Lord said he didn't speak of his own? Remember, he said, I have not spoken of myself, but the Father which sent me, he gave me a commandment, what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his commandment is life everlasting. Whatsoever I speak, therefore, even as the Father said unto me, so I speak. But it's important to realize and to understand that we're dealing with water just as we're dealing with the waters of Assyria. Not all water is equal. The water that came out of Jacob's well was differentiated from the water that Christ provides. It's different from the testimony of Jesus. If you drink the water from Jacob's well, the Lord told the woman at the well, you're going to thirst again. But if you drink of the water that I shall give you, not only are you never going to thirst, but the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. Which means that he's Emmanuel. He's God with us. And this is why Isaiah 8 tells us that the people themselves may not be devolved into masonry. They may be seeking to be honest, forthright Christians who abide by the spirit of prophecy. The only problem is they trust in their leaders. That's why it says, for as much as this people refuse the waters of Shiloh. Why would they be penalized from refusing the water of Shiloh? Because the waters of Shiloh are the waters that the Lord is referencing in John 4, the waters that work into everlasting life from the man that's going to distribute them. For as much as this people refuse the waters of Shiloh that go softly and rejoice in reason and Remaliah's son. Extracting a little bit more from Isaiah chapter 8 before we move on, it's important to understand that the time is going to come when the Lord is going to bring upon the church the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria, in all his glory. Again, and he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks. It goes to show you that the Lord is in control of the Assyrian. He causes him to overflow his channels because of the sins of the church. This is part of his work with the Assyrian. Which goes to show you the purpose of our location in the land of Assyria. He's a man that believes in freedom of religion. That's why, though, whatever he practices in his lodges, he does not impose it. He has restrictions. He has channels. He does not impose it upon all other religions that are in his land. He has opened up, for the first time in world history, a culture of multi-theological bastions. As a result, the Christian church has flourished in the United States of America. He got this ethic from his experience in England, which likewise gave allowances for the principles of freedom of religion. But the day is going to come when Assyria is no longer going to be a good working partner for the Lord, one that can preserve the sanctity of his church, because the Lord is going to cause the Assyrian to violate his constitution and to inundate with a flood the Seventh-day Adventist church. You're reading newspapers, you're listening to the radio, you have your ears tuned in to the current events, but I tell you, these things happen under the cover that you're not aware of. You're safe if you have personal responsibility for your theology, but if you're relying upon your leadership, then you're going to end up in their chariot and it's headed back towards Egypt. Well, what's the problem if waters mean doctrines? Well, the Assyrian River is contained by the Lord because their waters were polluted and corrupt. They're not refreshing. If the water from Jacob's well will cause you to thirst again, well, the Assyrian's filthy waters from his river will cause you to have dysentery and sickness, because that's where he dumps his waste in. We could take an excursion back into history of the church as it related to Egypt to find for us an allegory. I make reference to Exodus chapter 19, verses 4 through 5. Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians. Now we have a text that's referring the children of Israel to their experience in Egypt. They literally were delivered from Egypt. And they were taken into the wilderness. And the Lord heaped punishment upon the Egyptians. And that's the context of what we're reading here now. Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings, and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. The Lord told them that he delivered them from Egypt. But how did he say that he delivered them? He took them up on eagle's wings. Well, he's evidently being metaphoric. He didn't literally take them up on eagle's wings. But the metaphor, if it shows nothing else, it showed the need for them to travel to escape Egypt. And he put them down and began to speak with them the same way that he is beginning to speak with the church today, in the wilderness. We can allude back to that theme as we advance in the study. Let us now turn to Revelation chapter 12. This gospel doctrine is so well hidden by the Father that many people find it hard to believe that Assyria represents the land of the United States, the only land that offers religious freedom and protection to all religions. Let us read verse 5 and 6. And she brought forth a man-child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. Making reference to Jesus. The church gave birth to Jesus. That's the woman. Verse 6. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. As Christ delivered Israel from Egypt and took them into the wilderness, the woman was likewise taken into the wilderness, showing you the beauty and the harmony of type and antitypical analysis of symbolic speech, showing to you the reason why the church for the last 2,000 years has spent its focus and its time learning Bible history, so that today we can make use of it. These lessons are fresh in our minds and we can fully appreciate them. But the lesson thickens and the plot continues. Revelation chapter 12, again, verses 13 through 15. And when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. And to the woman were given 2 wings of a great eagle. You can see the metaphor and the emblematic parallels, can't you? That she might fly into the wilderness, into her place. Her place, place, place. That she might fly into the wilderness, into her place. Brother West, I know where you're getting at, and I'm very suspicious, you're thinking, because you're really disagreeing with what I've learned from E.G. White. We've been told all the years that heaven is our home. And then V.T. Hotef told us that Palestine is our home. And I'm not disagreeing with any of those themes, but I'm just showing you that you have a transitory home before you reach Palestine. And let it not be mistaken. It is her place. This is Emmanuel's land. Let's reread it. And to the woman were given 2 wings of a great eagle. That means that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. And that brings us up to date with Isaiah chapter 8. It shows you that the dragon didn't cast, as we formerly thought, people out of his mouth. To the contrary, he cast false doctrine out. Realizing that it's very difficult for people to be Bible-founded. Instead, they trust in their leaders. Therefore, they embrace the doctrines that he's able to endow and imbue to his leadership. And as a result, you've got 1,000 doctrinal questions you have to address now. Whereas in 1930, you just hit a few of them. Brother Hotef's job did not compare to the job that the woman has today, because she has to resist all these false doctrines that are being cast out. These are really emblematic of the dirty waters of the river of Assyria inundating and carrying away the church. You can see that now, can't you? She found refuge in the jungle, in the wilderness. And that worked. Why did it work? I keep wanting to emphasize the point because I know it's unique to the Davidian and Seventh-day Adventist ethos. Her peace came in the wilderness. Why? Because God planted her there. Because it was her land. That makes me reflect upon another text that we're all very familiar with. John chapter 14. The Lord speaking to His disciples. Lest you think that He's speaking to everybody? Not so. Because in John chapter 17, He says, speaking of His disciples as well, in verse 6, it tells you, I have manifest Thy name unto the men which Thou gavest me out of the world. Thine they were, and Thou gavest them me, and they have kept Thy word. Verse 9, I pray for them, I pray not for the world, but for them which Thou hast given me, for they are Thine. Verse 15, I pray not that Thou shouldest take them out of the world. This has been our passion as Adventists since 1844, right? It's been our focus. The Lord would rescue us from hell, from the corruption of the devil, and take us to heaven and whisk us off. The Lord says, that's not my will. I pray not that Thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that Thou shouldest keep them from the evil. Therefore, you can rest assured that although the dirty rivers of water inundating all of Davidian, all the Seventh-day Adventist church, if the Assyrian flood comes up to the neck of Judah, then being part of the head, the ruling class, you're preserved, you're protected from the evil in your place. John chapter 14, verse 1. Let not your heart be troubled. Ye believe in God, believe also in me. For in my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. A place for you. For you. For you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there ye may be also. Necessarily, therefore, and unequivocally, since the Lord promised to prepare a place, it had to be a place on earth because He was going to go away and He's going to return to receive them at the same geographical place. Oh, this is a message of empowerment. It's not a message of cowering, of running and of hiding, and of dashing and of darting and of fear. The Lord is going to come again and receive us unto Himself. Now we could go to Matthew chapter 25, whereby the king gathers all the nations before Him and He makes judgments upon them. Let us more carefully examine it. Verse 34, then shall the king say unto them on His right hand, come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Now we know the kingdom is merely the everlasting life. It doesn't have to be a geographical place. It's a theological place. It's been prepared for you from the foundation of the world. In fact, let me read verses 31 through 34. When the Son of Man shall come in all His glory. Remember, the Lord says He's going to come again and receive you unto Himself. And all the holy angels with Him, then shall He sit upon the throne of His glory. He comes with His holy angels. This is Christ's return to receive us unto Himself. The holy angels represent the Enochians. And before Him shall be gathered all nations. Then shall the king say unto them on His right hand, come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. As a result, we see the union of Christ in David, as David the king, the head of Judah, begins to pass judgments upon the people of the world. While He's yet in this place, the place where all nations have been gathered. The battle of Revelation, chapter 12 that we discussed, whereby the dragon casts out of His mouth a flood. It's a flood of Masonic false doctrine that compels the people to want to return to Egypt, to want to reject Moses. The Lord promised them He would send them a prophet like unto Moses, and He would speak through that prophet, signifying that that occurred 2,000 years ago through Jesus. they didn't want the prophet like unto Moses. And he's waited these 2,000 years to open up and unfold the truth in verity through the Son of David. Yet they did not want that enlightenment. What is the parallel in Scripture to this occurring? Numbers chapter 14, verses 2 through 4. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron. And the whole congregation said unto them, Would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would God we had died in this wilderness. They're at war with the light that the Lord offers them, just as the church is today. And wherefore hath the Lord brought us unto this land, to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return into Egypt? What worked them in such a hysterical eruption? What caused them to be so anxious? They were at war with the Lord's spirit of prophecy. The spirit of prophecy that promised them the kingdom. That promised them that he would deliver them to the land of Canaan. And they just simply did not believe it. Therefore, they wanted to reject Moses, the visible emissary who sought to lead them, and they wanted to realign themselves back to Egypt. All of these events were recorded allegorically so that we could see the reality, the verity of our redemption today. Doctrinal war is really disorienting. Because I say that Satan raised hell in heaven, and it was warfare doctrinally. You can't really get the picture, but you can understand what Moses went through when he's fighting against all these crying men devoid of faith. When he's fighting against all these people that have forgotten the miracles that delivered them from Egypt, that forgot the lashes across their back in Egypt, that forgot the fact that they were disempowered. They forgot all these things because they were disoriented in the wilderness, the place that God had prepared for them. And just because God had prepared the wilderness for them, that doesn't mean that that's going to be their permanent station. But even when you journey, don't you sometimes take a break and rest in a hotel to refresh yourself? Well, the Lord is just as concerned with the church. Thus, I celebrate the decoding of the Word of God. Egypt was the theology. The wilderness was the land of the church's temptation. Our series is entitled Veritable Redemption. We see the reality of our final struggle. The real and actual behind-the-scenes conflicts that assail us before we get our rose garden in our place, our home, in Assyria. You forgot about our study about the rose garden, didn't you? Well, it's contained within Isaiah chapter 30 through chapter 36. In fact, we find it in chapter 35. Verse 1, Palestine shall be glad for them. Heaven shall blossom as a rose. Is that what it says? See, I need somebody to correct my reading here. Verse 1 says, The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. See, your blossom occurs on this side of Palestine. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given unto it. That's the Millerite movement. The excellency of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord and the excellency of our God. This goes to show you that you are the head of the evangelical team. You're the one that's protected from the flood inundation of Assyria's filthy waters. You receive Lebanon, which means the amassing of people in the organization under the auspices of the coming of the Lord, however you define it. The excellency of Carmel and Sharon, you shall receive as well. All those benefits that you've won from the Seventh Day Adventist and the Divinity Seventh Day Adventist Church are your inheritance. The mustard seed is only building upon those doctrines. We started out with several doctrinal advances, and they're not going to be liquidated. They're just going to be clarified for our benefit. They're going to be explained for our foresight and for our knowledge. Even the rod doctrines of the slaughter of Ezekiel 9, the 144,000, the kingdom, the second coming, all of those doctrines were not for Sharon, Carmel, and Lebanon. They didn't fully understand. But today, when the light is unfolded and when the Bible is decoded so that we can become teachers, we're going to blossom and the world is going to see it and it's going to rejoice. The wilderness and the desert shall blossom as the rose. What is the desert? The desert is our place of desertion. We're the only people that subscribe to this light and to this truth, apart from those Enochians who have received my work. You know, Isaiah 49 tells you, the Lord hath called me from the womb. I have spent my strength for naught and in vain. Yet surely my judgment is with the Lord and my work with my God. So it looks as if to the world we have no power. We don't have a multitude of chariots. They're all racing towards Egypt. We're left behind. We're deserted. Isaiah 35 continues, strengthen ye the weak hand, confirm the feeble knees. Oh, the people of the world are going to love this because it's going to be re-empowerment. Won't need to take any more testosterone. They're going to say, you're going to have your hands strengthened and your feeble knees are going to be repaired. Say ye to them that are of a fearful heart, be strong. Fear not, behold, your God will come with vengeance. This blossoming occurs before the Lord returns. Even God with a recompense, he will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as in hart, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing. For in the wilderness shall the waters break out, and streams in the desert. Can you imagine some of these homeless people that are out there hobbling on canes or in wheelchairs, getting up and doing a moonwalk like Michael Jackson? These people are going to sing and they're going to rejoice and they're going to be re-empowered. So there's no reason for you to be fearful. And the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water, and the habitation of dragons, where each lay shall be grass with reeds and rushes. Have you seen any lion dragons around? I assume that refers to lizards, but it could also refer to the devil. And an highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for those, the wayfaring men, the fools shall not hear therein. So we're going to get the world to make a spiritual journey to us. There's no need for us to assume that this is a literal highway. This is a place of transportation. It's just as difficult for you to leave one religious idea behind and journey another as it is for you to jump in your car and go from one city to the next. Because in both cases, you're going to be completely disoriented. See, the floods are going to inundate Davidia up to the neck. That's why you want your theology to be above the neck. Because it excludes dirty theology. Unclean hands are not going to prevail in it. The land, in fact, has devolved into apostasy. Isaiah chapter 7, verse 23 through 25 says, And it shall come to pass in that day that every place shall be where there were 1,000 vines at 1,000 silverlings. It shall even be for briars and thorns. With arrows and with bows shall men come thither, because all the land shall become briars and thorns. This is not making reference to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It's referencing all the land. The land of Emmanuel. It has devolved into apostasy. So how is it that you have a conjunction, a conjoining of Egypt and Assyria so that they could be confusing? Especially since the Lord prepared the place for us, right? Isaiah chapter 57. The righteous perisheth, and no man layeth it to heart. Oh, that's such an important expression, because it gives you an idea of what heart circumcision means. It means a change of theology, of doctrine. It means a change of the ideas that you held dear to your heart yesterday have to be changed. But nobody is willing to study. That puts the Seventh-day Adventist Church and Davidia in a precarious condition as Christians. Because the Lord said in John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life." That's the most basic theme of Christology. Even in our public arenas, our Christian influence is still dominant, because you see people holding up signs of John 3:16. They're well aware of what it says. God loves the world. If you believe in his gospel truth, if you believe in his only begotten Son, you're not going to perish. But then, why is it that so many people over the last 2,000 years have died? People no longer have theological curiosity. And that's what the Bible means here in Isaiah 57, verse 1. The righteous perish, and none layeth it to heart. Nobody says, well, tell me, teach me, why is it, if John 3:16 is a veritable promise, why is it that the righteous people are dying? Well, thank God that the mustard seed is on hand to explain, as has done so in past studies, a veritable redemption. And we can understand why people have passed away. But it continues, and merciful men are taken away, none considering that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. It says merciful men are taken away. I can't help but see that as being a reference to the Enochians now. If there ever was such a thing as a rapture, it would be pertinent to the fact that the Lord has taken away some of the people that have been deemed merciful so that they could be preserved from the evil from the Assyrian inundation in the time to come. Therefore, I like the fact that it shows that there's two responses to the righteous. Some perish, and some are taken away. To reiterate, and merciful men are taken away, none considering that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. But draw near hither, ye sons of the sorcerers, the seed of the adulterer and the whore. Against whom do you sport yourselves? Against whom make ye a wide mouth and draw out the tongue? Are ye not children of transgression, a seed of falsehood? Verse 7. Upon a lofty and high mountain hast thou set. Upon a lofty and high mountain hast thou set thy bed. Manifestly, therefore, her bed has been fixed in place. Ever since England has become a Protestant nation, she set her bed upon the gospel of Jesus Christ. And as a result, she became a bastion of great theology around the world. But then corruption set in. She began to journey towards Egypt. Behind the doors, I told you, they do it with a covering. Also the post, hast thou set up thy remembrance, for thou hast discovered thyself to another than me, and art gone up. Thou hast enlarged thy bed, and made thee a covenant with them, and thou lovest their bed where thou sawest it. And thou wentest to the king with ointment. That's referring to the bastion of Pharaoh. She went to Pharaoh, whom she believed was the icon of God and his righteousness, as has been taught. But understand, she had to take a journey there. It's a theological journey. Thou wentest to the king with ointment, and didst increase thy perfume. For some of you, this may be quite a mature theme. But she was so zealous to climb in bed with the devil, even though he couldn't inspire her natural juices to flow for that engagement, that she took her own ointment. Her own KY jelly, so to speak. So as to facilitate the engagement. She was quite enthusiastic to climb in bed with him, even though her bed was set upon a high lofty mountain. And I went as to the king with ointment, and didst increase thy perfumes, and didst send thy messengers far off, and didst debase thyself even unto hell. So this is how Egypt becomes merged with Assyria. Egypt represents the apostate theology that has penetrated the Christian church. So much so that we saw in Revelation that the woman was taken into the wilderness, right? A place was prepared for her. That place could have only been England, the bastion of Protestantism. But then she had wings as an eagle, and she fled deeper into the wilderness. Shows that she advances to the United States of America, so that the Lord could continue to forward her freedom and forward her rejoice over his doctrine and over his truth. But now since she has depreciated it and has sought to clandestinely go back to Egypt, he's going to flood her with the filthy waters of the king of Assyria. Therefore, when you see the fact that the Jesuits and the Masons are controlling the leadership positions, they're in our schools, they're in our governance, they're in the body of the leaders in the church, then you know that we are in the epoch where the church is being flooded by the dirty waters of Assyria. He's inundating the church with his filthy work behind doors. Assyria represents the government structure. It was the government structure that set in place the principles of freedom of religion. Egypt represents the flood that the devil cast out of his mouth to destroy the woman. The governments are forcing the churches even now to clandestinely drink her filthy water. But you and I can find resolution in the fact that the woman will not be bullied. She's going to stand up for her Lord. And we can celebrate the fact that we belong to her hell escape team. That's why we have reinforced the concept that this is the day of empowerment. I often like to refer to the episode with Israel when Moses was mad with Israel and he smote the rock twice, which shows you that the church leadership smote Jesus. Then they rejected the mustard seed. But now is the day when the rock smites back. Now is the day when we are empowered to gain and garner admittance for the meek and the righteous and for those who are willing to escape the deceptions of Egypt and are willing to bask in our bastion and glory in our rose garden and drink from our fountain. We're able to reward them, but punishment is going to be heaped upon those who rebel. That's why we're told in Revelation chapter 2, verse 26, and he that overcometh, this is Jesus speaking. Jesus was given a rod of iron, it says, but he transfers it over to the overcomer. And he that overcometh and keepeth my works unto the end. Jesus' works represent those themes, those teachings, and those miracles that he did while Christ abode upon him, plus his inspiration of John in the book of Revelation. He that keepeth my works unto the end, to him will I give power over the nations. He doesn't keep it for himself. He gives it to the overcomer. And this, again, I refresh your memories on the original impetus of creation. Let us make man in our image,
and after our likeness, and let him have dominion over everything that moveth upon the face of the earth. Jesus facilitates that goal. The Father is made joyous because his kingdom that has been prepared from the foundations of the world is going to come to fruition. To him will I give power over the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron. As the vessels of a potter shall they be broken to shivers, even as I received of my Father, and I will give him the morning star. Therefore he endows to this servant the presence of Christ, the morning star. What do you think the Assyrian response will be when he hears these texts? Use our imagination just a little. What do you think it's going to be? He'll probably scoff. He'll probably laugh. But then something happens. The earth opens her mouth, and these doctrines are made evidentiary and plain. Then it causes him to feel the stroke of the Lord's anger. So he's beat by this gospel message. Isaiah chapter 30, verse 30. And the Lord shall cause his glorious voice to be heard. It's ignored now. But don't you think that if, for example, somebody tells you that the Twin Towers faltered because of their oppression of that Ethiopian young man they shot down in the streets? Dialis, I believe his name was. And then they worked in their secret lodges to garner a jury in Buffalo that finally acquitted him, the police officers that shot Diallo. Don't you think that it's going to be humiliating for them to realize the fact that the towers fell? And guess who fell? The people that were the police officers and the firemen. Those who retire in Buffalo from whence they garnered their jury for the trial of the accused police officers. Don't you think that when they're presented with factual evidence that's declared that they can't answer, it'll cause them to be disturbed? Because the Lord clearly tells you one simple thing. You go back and read it in Exodus 22. I believe it's in Deuteronomy chapter 10. It's repeated in Leviticus 19. He says to Israel, this is Christ speaking. Therefore, this is something, a principle that's going to be in vogue when he reinheres power. See, they may have been able to exploit the African Americans because they were under their punishment. But the Lord doesn't look on the outward appearance. He looks upon the heart. Diallo was a stranger in the land. He deserved their full protection. He said, if thou afflict the stranger, the widow, and the fatherless, I will kill you. And your wives will be widows and your children be fatherless. And that's exactly the message that needs to be delivered and broadcasted across Assyria. Do you think he's going to take kindly to the fact that these floods and these storms that are occurring are a response to the fact that the sons of Jerusalem are shot down like dogs in the streets, and they can't find a jury across the land to convict the officers? You're not going to let your own judgment system work? You know, you have to stand your ground laws so that you can just shoot down any black person that you feel is menacing? Let me send you a tornado and a hurricane. Let's see how well you can stand your ground now. You see, I mean, you see their houses and their mobile homes flowing down the rivers. That's what David said in Psalm chapter 37. He's going to turn their weapons on themselves. You see the 150 and some people that were gunned down? It wasn't a radical Muslim that gunned them down in Las Vegas. They were out there in Las Vegas protesting against the NFL protesters that just took a knee, a humble position, against oppression to support Black Lives Matter. Well, we don't believe that Black Lives Matter. So we're coming to Las Vegas to wave our phones at night, put the light on, and to show our support for the brutalizing police. Then all of a sudden, somebody heard a clip of a machine gun. The Lord turned their weapons on themselves. See, this is how the voice of the Lord beats down the Assyrian. Shows him that he can't lie his way out of his troubles. Isaiah chapter 30, verse 30. And the Lord shall cause his glorious voice to be heard, and shall show the lighting down of his arm with the indignation of his anger, and with the flame of a devouring fire, with scatterings and tempest and hailstones. For through the voice of the Lord shall the Assyrian be beaten down, which smote with a rod. See, the Egyptian isn't beaten down. The Assyrian who embraced Egyptian theology is beaten down, who smote with a rod. At some point in time, this country is going to know the emergence of the mustard seed. It's going to come out of hiding. That's why we're told in Revelation chapter 11, verse 1, and there was given me a reed like unto a rod. And the angel stood, saying, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. But the court which is without the temple leave out, and measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles. And the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. A time period of their affliction is placed upon this scripture. 3.5 years. What that shows you is that there's going to be an awakening so that they will begin to realize that Jerusalem, by the voice of the Lord, vindicated by theology and broadcast by the earth opening up her mouth, is going to show that Jerusalem represents the sons of America's former slaves. They don't know that or understand it right now. But when that message is broadcast, you know that they're going to tread them down for merely 3.5 years. Let's see a little bit more about the voice of the Lord and the great and marvelous work that it's going to do. Isaiah chapter 29, verse 13 through 15. Wherefore the Lord said, for as much as this people, he's talking about the Assyrian, including the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Wherefore the Lord said, for as much as this people draw near me with their mouth, and with their lips do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me. How did they remove their heart far from him? They took a theological journey. They created a greater gulf and distance between them and the Lord. And their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. We could have emphasized the point in Isaiah chapter 31, where he says, the woe that's placed upon the church, they've gone down to Egypt on horses. He addresses the logic and the illogic of that transgression and of that journey by saying, now the Egyptians are men. They're not God. These people teach by the precepts of men and not by the precepts of the Spirit of God. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and wonder, for the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid. So those men who sought to exact tyranny upon their flocks and upon the people under their control because they think that they have pegged God into their little pigeonhole definition, they're going to be completely humiliated. And that all comes with the earth opening up her mouth and the doctrines of the scriptures being unfolded and revealed to the public. And the sins of masonry are exposed. That's why he says in verse 15, woe unto them that seek deep to hide their counsel from the Lord, and their works are in the dark. And they say, who seeth us, and who knoweth us? Surely your turning of things upside down shall be esteemed as the potter's clay. For shall the work say of him that made it, he made me not? Or shall the thing that frame say of him that framed it, he had no understanding. Therefore, our study, in answer to the Assyrian-Egyptian paradoxy, takes us even further and shows us the reality of the events that are going to unfold as we continue to proceed towards the kingdom. The son of David, the Lord's opposing light to masonry, must prevail to become her single eye capstone, the light of the world. Assyria will be beaten down, and the doctrines of Egypt will be the egg on their faces as our light breaks forth on the morning from the land prepared for us by Christ. Then we can study about our relocation to Palestine. And with that, I bring the study to a close.